hear your favorite NFL legends sharing their stories and insights every week right here on Thursday Night Tailgate with Chris Mascaro and Bob Lazzari. Take it away, guys.
When the door is locked, there's no way out.
And now back with us here on Thursday Night Tailgate is one of the greatest hitters of all time, and that's Al Oliver. Let me remind you a little bit more about Al's background. He's from Portsmouth, Ohio, which is in the southern part of the state across the Ohio River from Kentucky. Signed by the Pittsburgh Pirates as an amateur free agent back in 1964. Played in the major leagues from 1968 to 1985 for the Pirates, Rangers, Expos, Giants, Phillies, Dodgers, and Blue Jays. Had a lifetime batting average of .303. Had 2,743 hits, 219 home runs, and drove in 1,326 runs. He was a seven-time All-Star. Won the Silver Slug Award three times. He was the National League batting champion in 1982, leading the league in hits, RBIs, extra base hits, doubles, and runs created. And like we've said every time Al has been a part of the show, what is keeping this man out of the Hall of Fame remains a mystery to both Bob and I, but we are very honored he is back with us again tonight here on Thursday Night Tailgate. Hey, Al, Chris, and Bob, thanks for coming back on the show.
Come back, Al. Okay, gentlemen. Hey, it's always a pleasure.
So, Al, one of the things that, you know, is always been amazing to us is, you know, your stature within the Hall of Fame. With a guy that has the credentials that you do, and I named off a bunch of them, and on top of that, you helped the Pirates win a World Series in 71. You were one of the best hitters in the league for 18 years. Is it getting any closer? Are we getting any closer to getting you in the Hall of Fame?
If anything, I think that we're going farther away because of this year's guys who were nominated. This was my group of players that if I was going to be nominated, I would have been one of the top 10 because it went from 19, if I'm not mistaken, from 1970 through 1988. And actually that encompasses my whole career. So what they did, as it turned out, they took my whole career and just threw it in the trash can and forgot all about me. So that's something that I really don't talk much about because it's a big mystery. No one knows. I don't know. But just like my grandson told me, he said, people, you are more than a Hall of Fame. All that you need to do is just keep doing what you're doing, helping people, being a good man, and that's the most important thing that you can do in life. And he's right.
Kudos to him. He is right. When I look back over your amazing career and things you got to be a part of and players you played with and against, boy, it's just a who's who of Major League Baseball.
It really is.
You had an opportunity in the 72 All-Star game to be, you know, for at least a night on the same team with Willie Mays, on the same team, you know, with Hank Aaron. Hank Aaron, I believe, was a guy that you actually replaced in that game later on in that game. But what was it like for a night to be a part of the same team with some of the greatest players of all time?
Well, number one, that was one night that I knew that I wouldn't be starting. When I look at these players like Mays and Aaron and Clemente, and of course you had Stargell, you had Brock, you had Billy Williams, that was a game where you just sit back and enjoy. I had no idea that I would have the opportunity in that particular game to go in the game. But by us winning the World Series in 1971, Danny Murtaugh was our manager. And so eventually, by us playing in Atlanta, he says, Scoop, get your glove. And once Hank goes out to right field, I want you to go out there and replace him. And I tell people to this day, it's probably the only time that I didn't start a game and had to replace someone that I felt good about it. And to see Hank get the ovation that he got in Atlanta, that was a great thrill for me to have an opportunity to replace the great Hank Aaron. But that was a heck of a team, you know.
No
just
doubt.
Like the 71 team, which I didn't make. But the 72 team was awesome.
Al, Bob Gibson started that All-Star game in 72, and I'm sure you faced Gibson dozens of times back then.
Yeah.
What was it like digging into the batter's box when Gibson was on the mound?
I was very fortunate. I was left-handed. Now, he struggled with me. If I'm not mistaken, I think I was at around 340 off of him in my career. And he struggled with me, but I had this respect about him. And I think the reason why I had some success against Bob Gibson was the fact that the attitude that he had, I had. You know, I felt very confident that I could hit any pitcher, and he felt very confident that he could hit or pitch two and get out just the other way around. But I think we only have two competitors like that. One's going to come out on top. And now, if he would have been a left-handed pitcher, now he might have given me a little problem. But facing him was a challenge. I had to be right in order to hit him. And as we know, he wasn't afraid to drill people. I saw him drill Clemente. I saw him drill Stargell. I saw him drill Parker. But he really never drilled me. He would always come inside to get me off of the plate. But he never drilled me, and I never could figure that out why, because usually I was the guy that really hurt him. But I really enjoyed watching him. I mean, he was just an athlete with intimidation, and you didn't want to show him up. And, you know, I've always said there's two pitchers that I would pick. If I'd pick two pitchers to win one ball game during my time, of course, it would be Bob Gibson or Tom Seaver. Both of those guys were tough. And I feel sorry for a lot of those right-handed hitters against Bob Gibson. I really did. I'm just glad that I was on the left side.
Al, you mentioned Danny Murtaugh a moment ago, and my recollection, and like I say, I grew up in Pittsburgh and watched you guys back all through the 70s, and Murtaugh looked like a father figure out there to me,
yeah,
from my perspective. But what was he like for you guys?
The same way. The one thing that I always respected about the skipper was the only thing he did, he set his lineup up and let us go out there and play. He let us play. And the only way that we wouldn't play was if we played ourselves out of the lineup. And that's all he expected from us. And, of course, the one night I never forget, on September the 1st, 1971, he started an all-minority team, which has never happened in baseball history. And they asked him after the game, did he realize what he was doing? Well, was to post up an all-minority team. And he said, no, I had no idea. The only thing that he did was post the lineup that he thought that could win that game that night. And that's the kind of guy he was. And he was a great manager because what he could do, and none of us wanted to sit down, not one game. We wanted to play 162 games, which we knew we couldn't do because we had guys on the bench that could play also. But what he could do, he could look at a player, and if they weren't stinging the ball like they were capable, he would sit them down and give them a rest. But I respect him. He would at least ask the player if they needed a day off. Because I know he did it with me one time. I never forget, because I was always geared mentally and physically for 162 games. And he called me in his office one day and said, "Scoop, you know, you're getting your base hits, but you're not hitting those line drives. I think you need a day off." I said, "Skip, I hear you talking, but give me one more game." And it was out in San Diego. I go out and get three hits. So I said, "Well, you know, that's okay." But I thought about what he said. And after the game, I walked into his office. I said, "Okay, Skip, you can give me a day off." He did. And after that, I went on the road. Those were the things that he could spot in each player. And each player respected him. They didn't argue with him. He was a father figure. Yes, he was. He enjoyed laughing. He had to. With those guys that we had on our team, you had to have a sense of humor. When you had guys like Doc Ellis, and, you know, who was a character and a clubhouse lawyer, and Dave Justy and Steve Blast, and we had a team full of personalities that just gelled well. And he realized what he had. And so what he did was he managed us. Because a lot of times you can have great talent, then all of a sudden you make a mistake. You try to manage. If you have the talent and they're doing well, you just leave alone. And that's what he was able to do.
Bob, questions for Al?
Al, it's always a pleasure to speak with you, especially around the holidays. And Merry Christmas to you and your family. And thanks for coming on, as usual. And I have to ask you, Al, people associate your 10 years or so in Pittsburgh with Three River Stadium. But actually, you started those first couple years in the 60s, late 60s, you were at Forbes Field. Remind our listeners about what it was like playing in the old Forbes Field.
Well, number one, it was very unique. And the more I thought about it over the years, you know, I came up as a first baseman. And luckily, when I did make the adjustment from first base to center field, it was in Three River Stadium. And I could just see myself now playing center field in Forbes Field. I would still be running. Because back in those days, they had the batting cage out there in the right center field. And, you know, that's a lot of ground to cover. I know Bill Verdon did a great job being center fielder, and Matty Alou and guys before him. But playing in Old Forbes Field, the thing that I really enjoyed about it, it was fan-friendly. Back then, the players signed autographs. You know, the players were right there next to the fans, and the fans were close to the players. And if they would call you, you couldn't hide from them. You had to go over to where they were to sign autographs. You know, sometimes you try to sneak away. But I was one, I couldn't do that. I never could turn down autographs. That was one of my weaknesses. If there were 50 people there, I had to sign all 50. So I had to make my mind up. Either I had to sign them one or sign all 50. I couldn't sign 48 or 49 and walk away. But that's where it was back then. We enjoyed signing autographs. And that was a total appreciation, more so, I feel, for the fans than it is right now.
And Al, we've talked about this before, and I'm sure we'll talk about it again because I think it's a fascinating subject. And that's the game of today, where I consider less hitters than there were in your era, but more sluggers now. And the reason why I say that, your highest strikeout total was about 70 a year, and I think you averaged about 45 a year for your career. Guys do that in a month now. How do you watch the current game, and is it frustrating to you, Al? You must laugh and almost cry at the same time.
I do more laughing than anything else. I have to admit, I just chuckle. But see what has happened, they've gone with this launch angle. They want players to pull the ball and hit home runs. And in my opinion, what you're doing, you're taking away something from a good hitter who could be a 300 hitter if he uses the whole field. Because that's why they have two lines, a left field line and a right field line. And you should be able to hit the ball where it's pitched. Because there are exceptions. There are some guys who are more poor hitters. But they have a lot of players with this launch angle. And I think it really hurts the game. I really see a guy hit a line drive to the opposite field because base hits are good all over the field. And they take too many pitches. They're guessing. They're taking fastballs on a called third strike right down the middle of the plate. And then they turn around and look at the umpire. And that's when I really laugh. Because what could you be looking for? You know, you got to look fastball as a rule and adjust to something slower, which is a curveball or slider or this fifth finger ball that they throw, but pitchers today, every pitcher has at least 7-8 pitches. And you just don't know what to look for, but you got to look fastball and adjust. That launch angle, I'm not really big on. You should be quick enough if they do throw you inside, you should be able to turn on the ball. And that's the difference that I've seen. There are more strikeouts than I've ever seen. It's almost unbelievable. And the pitch count is what I don't get. You know, of course, you know, when I came up, there was no pitch count. I just see someone going out to the mound and try to bring Bob Gibson out after 55 pitches. Or Tom Seaver or Steve Carlton. All the great pitchers that were in the 60s, the 50s. You just couldn't do that. These guys were geared to go as long as they could, and then you could bring in the bullpen.
So to that point, Al, it seems like, you know, pitchers are held like a commodity where we got to protect them. We don't want to, you know, you talk about pitch count. You know, they start to get close to 100, and everyone starts to panic, and it's time to pull them out and all that sort of stuff. I'm not sure. I mean, you correct me if I'm wrong here, but all of the guys that you mentioned, and Nolan Ryan's been a big proponent and all that sort of stuff. I mean,
yeah,
you got to build the shoulder up. You got to make it strong. Letting these guys go. I mean, there were times, and Bob and I are both, you know, also Red Sox fans, and you'd see the Red Sox, and a guy would go 3 innings, and then he'd bring in a guy for one, and another guy for one, and another guy for 2/3, another guy for a third. I mean, there's like 6, 7, 8 pitchers in a game. I mean, that's craziness, isn't it?
I think it is. You know, and I've seen more pitching coaches. You know how you're into steps. You know, how many steps, you know, if you're into the conditioning thing.
Right.
How many steps does a pitching coach make per game? The pitching coaches should be probably in better condition than the pitchers.
Yeah.
As often as they go, but I have to laugh about it because it just doesn't make sense to me. You know, why they've gone that way, because that's why you go to spring training. That's why you work out during the off season. You know, to build up that stamina and that strength in your arm, you know, that's like hitters. You know, you go to spring training and you try to become the best hitter you can, and that's by using the whole field. But come season time, things just change. But I still watch the game at least the first 4 or 5 innings, because usually about 10 o'clock, I'm gone. You know, I'm one of those guys that I go to bed early, I wake up early. And usually probably about a half an hour from now, I've clocked out, especially after the 6th inning. And the game has changed. There's so many rules. And just to touch on the Hall of Fame briefly, is that, and I have to respect Ted Simmons. Ted went in this year, and he said something that I will always respect him for. Is that he said the reason why he's a Hall of Famer today is because of analytics, sabermetrics, and war. And I'm glad to hear him say that, because what that has done, it has kept some players out of the Hall and it put some players in the Hall. Because when I came up, you were just based on one thing, and that was your career. I never heard of analytics before, or sabermetrics, or war, and I still don't know what it means, but that's the big thing now as far as the Hall of Fame is concerned. Maybe one day someone will be able to explain that to me, but that's what they go on now, as opposed to a guy's career, and I don't think that's fair.
And Al, because if I think about a couple of former Pirates that I think are getting robbed of being in the Hall of Fame, it's you and Dave Parker.
Dave
he was an unbelievable athlete. What do you remember about him?
You know, I talked to him a couple of days ago, and we talk at least 3 or 4 times a month. And the thing is that here's a guy his size who could run, he could field, he could throw. He could hit for power and average. He could do it all. And the thing that I always liked about Dave was he had the supreme confidence. And, of course, I've always enjoyed being around people who are very confident in their abilities and very positive in their approach toward the game, in which Dave was. And I've always said that if there was a Hall of Famer, he is one. Because I know what a Hall of Famer is, because I've played with quite a few of them. And of course, in Pittsburgh, I played between two. And so Dave Parker belonged in the Hall. We talked about that the day after the voting. And he said, well, Scoop, you know, you should be in there too. I said, well, I'll give you the edge. You definitely should be in there because you could do it all. I mean, you had the awards and you were just a total all-around player. And I just hope that his next go-round, he has that opportunity to go in. Me, I'll just sit back and grab me a good seat when he does go in and enjoy his induction speech.
Al, I want to take you back to August 9th, 1976. You caught the final out in John Candelaria's no-hitter that night against the Dodgers. And it was a little fister that kind of blooped to short center field. And Frank Tavares is running out. You're running in. Wasn't an easy play at all. Do you remember? Were you nervous? Or you think, whatever happens, I got to make this catch because he can't let, you know, lose the no-hitter on that.
But, you know, like Bob Prince used to say, we had them all the way.
Right.
Well, I had it all the way. And I didn't realize this until years later, how close we came to colliding.
Right.
And I'm saying to myself, what is Frankie doing out here? He knows I got this ground covered out here. But I didn't realize how close it was. But that was a thrill. And you talking about somebody who could pitch. Candy was tough. And I'm just glad that I was part of that no-hitter. You know, I was fortunate enough to be in a few with Doc Ellis and Bob Moose. And those were thrills. But as far as that particular ball, it was a fister. But I was fortunate enough to get a good jump on that ball, and that's why I was able to get to it.
Hilltop hat. You guys started wearing those in 76, and then they had all the different combinations of uniforms and all that sort of stuff. What was it like when they came to you guys and said, hey, this is what we're going to wear this year?
Well, we had to wear them, number one. But John Hallahan, who was our equipment guy, I was just surprised that he never got it mixed up. You know, when we walk into the clubhouse, we would always look up on the board to see what uniform that we were wearing. And I tell people that good thing that we could hit and that we could play because anybody could not have worn those uniforms and get away with it. it was amazing when I look back at those changes that we had to make. My favorite one was the all black.
Is that right?
My favorite. Yeah, that was my favorite uniform because it kind of fit our personality. You know, we had these not rough guys, but aggressive and tough looking guys. Like we would just eat up a baseball. You know, it just fit our personality, and that was always my favorite because of the way it fit. It was very form fitting, and
It wasn't
the
hot.
Pinstripe one, we didn't wear that much, the pinstripe. But I like that one too. And we really didn't have any fat guys on our team. You know, like Steve Brass said, even, I think it was Eddie Kirkpatrick. Even he looked good in his uniform. but yeah. I enjoyed the change. It was very, very interesting, and it fit our personality. I think that was the key.
That all black wasn't hot? Like, I can't imagine what that was like in the summertime.
Well, I don't think we wore it in St. Louis. or Fifth and
Bush Stadium on the AstroTurf in 130 degrees?
Now, I'll tell you what, some of that turf was tough. I think they knew how to put the colors together, you know, as far as not when, when it was super hot. You know, maybe if you went to San Diego where the weather is always the same, usually in the low 70s, or in San Francisco, we actually needed flannel uniforms at those night games. I mean, that, San Francisco was some kind of place. If we played every game at noon, we'd have been fine. But come game time, it's 40 degrees. And I still can't figure that out. It was just amazing to play at San Francisco. And we had to be right because they had some good pitching. And they had a good team, too. But it was neat to wear those uniforms, so very neat. Good thing that we could play.
Bob, one more for Al before we let him go.
Sure, Al. I've told you in the past that I just marveled at your 2 years in Montreal, especially the first one, where at the age of 35 here, you lead the league in hits, doubles, RBIs, batting average, total bases. Just an amazing year. And at age 35, not that that's really old, but Al, did you foresee this coming? And what about hitting at Olympic Stadium?
That didn't bother me. A lot of guys had trouble hitting in that stadium, but I was what my mother told me when I was 4 or 5 years old, that Junior's going to be a ball player. And I just wanted to play ball. And I think the reason why at age 30, 35, I had that kind of year was it was my conditioning level that I kept myself at. You know, if baseball would have allowed me, I probably, and especially DHing, I probably could have gone at least, well, not probably, I would have gone 4 or 5 more years easily because of the conditioning. You know, I was a pro racquetball player, and during the off season, that's what I did. I played racquetball and I went to spring training and I was in shape. And that's the reason why I never slowed down as far as speed. I still had the bat speed. The only problem that I had when I went to Montreal, I had a bone spur in my shoulder, and I had trouble throwing at times. But other than that, in my career, that was the only injury that I had. But I would love to have stayed around and became a DH, and I could play 4 or 5 more years easily.
Al, before we let you go, let our listeners know what you're doing now and how they can stay up to date with all of those things, whether it's on your website or anywhere else on social media.
Right. Of course, my website is just www.aloliver. You can get there. And what I do, I actually travel around the world doing motivational speaking. That's something that I've always enjoyed doing. I think what had a lot to do with that was the positive attitude that I always had. You know, like some people say, I had that from birth. And I think that in today's society, we need more positive things. Just like I was listening to toward the end of what Lee was saying, and I have to amen him on what he's doing, because he's doing positive things. He's getting players involved in their communities. We need more people that are positive and being more a part of the community. But I do travel around the world doing motivational speaking. I'm also a life minister as well. So the combination of the two pretty much keeps me busy. I would like to be more busy than what I am now. Just like my son said, well, Dad, the problem with you is that you're too laid back. You need to get somebody to represent you because you have a story to be told. Maybe like none other athlete, maybe whoever plays sport. People just don't know you. And I know the two subjects that I talk a lot about is life is a hit, don't strike out. Now, that applies to everything. You have to go to the plate in order to strike out. We need more people to go to the plate and make a difference in their community and in this country and around the world. And more importantly, the one that is very key today, more so than ever, get on base, not on drugs. Those are the two subjects that I use. when I travel, you know, speaking. So, yeah, I can be reached on the website at www.aloliver. And I'm there for the taking.
Well, Al, we can't thank you enough for coming back and being a part of the show. It's always a treat for us to get to spend some time with you and hear more and more of your stories. We hope you'll come back and do it again real soon.
Absolutely. Yeah, you guys take care and have a Merry Christmas as well.
We love you.
Merry Christmas. Happy New Year to you and your family as well, Al. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Good night, sir.
Good night.
That's the great Al Oliver. Bob, you know, we talk all the time about, you know, some of the privileges that we have speaking to some of the greatest athletes that played. Most of the times it's in football, but sometimes it's in baseball. And when you look at all of the things that Al accomplished, it's a tremendous resume. And I just sort of shake my head. I don't know what the baseball writers of America are looking at when they see what Al did and say, you know, and pass on him to get into the Hall. That's something that doesn't make any sense. He's 18 years, 300 batting average. To me, you know, on top of the Silver Sluggers and the All-Star games and all that sort of stuff and a world championship. I don't know, man. I can't figure that one out.
Well, Chris, I think I have an idea what they're looking at. You have a younger crowd that's going to be voting for years to come, obviously, and they forget about guys like him that were more line drive hitters. They were hitters. They're not sluggers back then. They were hitters, Chris. And if you look at his strikeout totals were very low, but his walk totals were low, too. So you're not going to see a great, great, great on-base percentage. But it's all the other things, the doubles and the singles and the triple. And
right.
Al did it all. And just the lack of strikeouts. He put the bat on the ball all the time. That meant a lot to those guys back then. It's a totally different game now, and it's totally different guys following it. And that's Al's problem, though. But, again, we're privileged to have him, Chris, not only as a guest but as a friend. I mean, I could hear him speak all day long. I'm just amazed at him. The presence he has when he speaks and the things he brings up during our conversations, just fascinating. The places he played with, the players he played with, the places where he played. I look forward to him. Every time we hang up with him, I can't wait to speak with him again. He's that special.
Yes, he is. And I couldn't have said it any better than that because you're 100% spot on.